Sure, why not? Good morning. It is 10 a.m., January 27th, 2010. This is the North Dakota Public Service Commission at our regularly scheduled biweekly meeting. Kevin Kramer, along with Tony Clark and Brian Kalk. Welcome, everybody. Any opening comments from my colleagues?
Good morning and welcome.
Good morning and welcome.
Is there a motion to approve the consent agenda?
So moved.
Second.
I have nothing in it, so I thought I better not move it.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Very good. Moving into the regular agenda, KC1. I move the commission conditionally approve revision number 27 to surface coal mining permit number BNCR 9702 held by BNI Coal LTD for the Center Mine to extend mining onto a federal coal tract within the existing permit area and to update other information and plans in the permit.
Second.
This is just simply updating the permit to accommodate a 40-acre tract of federal coal that's within the permit area. BNI does have a lease for that coal, and this just clears the way for them to then receive the rest of the approval from the Department of the Interior. So everything seems to be in order.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. KC2. I move the commission acknowledge the letter of intent, shorten the one-year waiting period between filing a letter of intent and a siting application to 30 days, and assess a filing fee of $100,000 in case number PU-09750, Bridger Pipeline LLC's proposed 10-inch crude oil pipeline in McKenzie, Dunn, and Billings counties of North Dakota.
Second.
This is a rather interesting pipeline project as far as pipeline projects go in North Dakota, as the motion states. It is an 85-mile pipeline, all contained in North Dakota. It's a 10-inch pipeline that that becomes part of the and by the way, I do have copies of the cheat sheet, if you will, on the Bridger pipeline, as well as a couple of maps. I printed out in color the map of this line, and I also added a copy of the Bridger Pipeline Montana's map, because it gives a pretty clear illustration of how this line will interact with the Montana line. But it is an 85-mile, 10-inch crude pipeline in McKenzie, Dunn, and Billings counties, North Dakota, to receive deliveries of crude oil in McKenzie, Dunn, and Billings counties for transport to potential markets served in the Guernsey, Wyoming, Clearbrook, Minnesota, and Bismarck markets. And therein lies sort of the interesting part of this pipeline. It presents no new necessarily transport or interstate transport opportunities, but it does make very efficient the movement of oil from three of our counties into existing transmission systems that provide access to three different markets. And as we know, much of the discount over the last few years that our producers have been being paid is as a result of single market, being captured by a single market. So this pipeline and Bridger, by the way, is owned by True Companies, and we're quite familiar, of course, with True. They've been doing business in North Dakota for at least three generations that I can think of. They also own the Belle Fourche pipeline system in North Dakota. But this 85 miles with three gathering pipeline interconnects and two truck receipt points in Montreal County would interconnect with their existing Little Missouri system at Fryburg Station in Billings County. That's a line that runs from Fryburg, North Dakota, to Baker, Montana, which then takes oil then down into the Guernsey and Denver markets. Also, the Belle Fourche Pipeline Company's existing system at Skunk Hill Station, which is also in Billings County. And then the crude oil could ultimately be delivered, as I said, to Guernsey, Wyoming, via the Little Missouri and the Butte systems, and then to Clearbrook, Minnesota, via the existing system operated by Bridger, Belle Fourche, and Enbridge, or to the Tesoro refinery in Mandan via the Belle Fourche pipeline. So besides providing the most efficient and economic means of transporting oil to those multiple markets, it, of course, as always, reduces oil tanker traffic on county, state, and federal roads, which is both a safety issue and, of course, again, an economic issue. So everything seems to be in order. We expect that an application would come in fairly soon. They want construction to begin in the summer of this year and be completed by January of 2011, anticipated that it would be about a $25 million total investment by the company.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And that ends items in my portfolio.
Thank you.
Commissioner Clark.
Item TC1. I move the commission issue an order in case number GE1021, canceling warehouse license number 205 issued to Goodrich Farmers Co-op Association at Goodrich, North Dakota, and ordering that business at Goodrich, North Dakota is discontinued effective January 19th, 2010. The licensing division received this request from Goodrich Farmers Co-op Association. They are selling a couple of facilities, or breaking the facilities apart. The east elevator has been sold and will be licensed to Dean Steichen and Gloria Steichen, doing business as Steichen Farmers East Elevator, and that will be in a subsequent motion. The west elevator has been sold and will be licensed to CC Grain LLC. CC Grain LLC has assumed the outstanding storage obligations for the grain inventory that are stored in that west elevator. And that also will be in a subsequent motion.
All in favor?
Aye.
TC2, I move the commission issue an order. I haven't had any coffee today.
Yeah, he's suddenly he's king for the day.
I move the commission issue an order in case number GE1015, granting the request of Dean Steichen and Gloria Steichen, doing business as Steichen Farms East Elevator, to operate a 389,000 bushel grain warehouse at Goodrich, North Dakota, effective January 19th, 2010. I further move the commission grant the request of Dean Steichen and Gloria Steichen, doing business as Steichen Farms East Elevator, to operate the grain warehouse at Goodrich, North Dakota, on an as-needed basis.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
TC3, I move the commission issue an order in case number GE1028, granting the request of CC Grain LLC to operate a 167,000 bushel grain warehouse at Goodrich, North Dakota, effective January 19th, 2010. I further move the commission grant the request of CC Grain LLC to operate the grain warehouse at Goodrich, North Dakota, on an as-needed basis.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
TC4. I move the commission deem the application complete and issue a notice of opportunity for hearing on waiver application in case number PU09674, Otter Tail Power Company's proposed 230 kV electric transmission line reroute in Sargent County, North Dakota.
Second.
In early January of this year, Otter Tail filed for a waiver of procedures and time schedules. It's related to a small reroute that they are proposing. It's approximately 0.53 miles, so just over a half-mile reroute of a 230 kV electric transmission line near Fiala Lake in Sargent County. Otter Tail is asserting that the proposed reroute will produce only minimal adverse effects, and they're proposing that there's a demonstrable emergency that exists, and it relates to the fact that this part of the line is near the lake, which has expanded, and they're looking to avert any contact with spring ice flows. This is, because it is a very small reroute, we're offering just an opportunity for a hearing. If any individual or party wishes to request that they have a hearing, they need to have comments and those requests received by the commission by February 22nd of 2010.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. TC5, I move the commission issue a notice of hearing in BNSF Railway Company's application for review of the Frayne Barracks Railroad crossing at Bismarck, North Dakota, case number RR10-26.
Second.
This and the next motion are both related to the topic of when a rail company railroad needs to blow their whistles at private crossings. This particular one is one that I expect will receive some attention because it is in a major metropolitan area, at least by North Dakota standards. It's within the city of Bismarck, and related to Frayne Barracks, there is a crossing which BNSF indicates is a private crossing on the back end of Frayne Barracks. And it's also fairly close to Highland Acres residential area, and traditionally that whistle has been blown with the new state law that took effect January 1st of this year. However, at private crossings, there is an assumption that train whistles not be blown unless the commission deems that they should be blown at those private rail crossings. This one, I expect, will generate some interest by the public. As I said, it is close to a residential section of town. It is within a metropolitan area. The commission has begun receiving comments already on it from probably most notably the National Guard itself, which owns the crossing. BNSF, in their petition, I noticed, didn't take a strong advocacy role one way or another. I think that they're mainly looking for some guidance on this particular issue, and they're looking for the commission to make a determination on how we feel it should move forward, whether there is a safety issue, and whether we believe that the train whistles should still need to be blown at that location. The public hearing that we're setting up for both this and the subsequent motion, which will deal with a private crossing near Manville, is going to be scheduled for March 1st of this year at 1:30 p.m. here in the commission hearing room, 12th floor, State Capitol.
All in favor?
Aye. And item TC6, I move the commission issue a notice of hearing in BNSF Railway Company's application for review of two private railroad crossings near Manville, North Dakota, case number RR10-27.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. That ends the items in my agenda.
Very good. Commissioner Culp.
Good morning. Item BK1. I move the commission adopt the order approving an interconnection agreement negotiated between United Telephone Mutual Aid Corporation and Mid-Continent Communications, case number PU09723.
Second.
On December 2nd, 2009, Mid-Continent filed a petition for approval of an interconnect agreement with United Telephone. Typically, these petitions are posted on our website for 90 days for the public to comment. In this case, the parties petitioned to request that we shorten that time. So on December 10th, we issued a notice of opportunity for comment to stay open until January 25th. At that time, we'd received no comments. We have reviewed the agreement and found it to be in order.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
That concludes the items in my portfolio.
Very good. That concludes the meeting, and we have a few announcements. There is, first of all, an informal hearing this afternoon with First Link to discuss and hear from them about the 211 designation in Cass County and statewide. Monday, February 1st at 10 o'clock, we will have a siting application hearing for the, Elite Inc., the 230 kV transmission line in Morton and Oliver counties. And that will be held at the Oliver County Courthouse in Center, again beginning at 10 o'clock Monday, February 1st. Also, we did issue a news release this morning as well, and announcing that North Dakota has, for the first time, broken into the top 10 in wind energy producing states in the nation. We are now ranked 10th in wind energy production, according to a report released by the American Wind Energy Association. It just goes to show, I think, that North Dakota continues to be the go-to place for investment and production of both traditional and renewable energy resources, and landmarks like this can only be achieved when citizens and industry and government leaders all work together toward a common goal. So it's fun. It wasn't that many years ago that they designated us as having the best potential for wind development. So it's always fun when you sort of start realizing your potential and realizing, of course, we have 9 more slots to go to get to number one, and there are a lot of other obstacles between between this point and that point. But nonetheless, it's a landmark day. Anything else from my colleagues?
I just had one thing I'd like to add. Sure. Just a thank you to MDU, Otter Tail, and Excel. I talked to all their points of contact this morning, and power is up for them fully. They're still working out some long-term issues, but the investor-owned utilities are sitting pretty well right now. I know we're working a lot of issues with the co-ops, but just thanks to our investor-owned utilities.
Last week I stayed in Kindred one night. My dad gave me a ride into Fargo for the grain dealers, actually, convention, and he said, "This is bad. This is the worst weather," which is why all of his hooks and climbing belt and stuff were hanging in my office. He said the worst part about this high moisture, warm weather in January is that after it snaps all the lines, then it gets really cold and makes it doubly difficult to fix them. So he was right on. But they're all doing a great job.
To put on the,
he was not. No, he wasn't begging for to go back to work. He was relieved he didn't have to. Anyway, are there any questions?
The bridge or pipeline is,
I'm looking at the map on page 2 of the handout. Is the pipeline the black dotted line?
It is, the one that runs north to south.
Okay. Yeah. And does it hook into the Enbridge line, the north?
There is a Bridger, part of the Bridger system that does do that. So this line hooks into the Enbridge system, the Belle Fourche system, and then the Bridger system to Baker, Montana, which goes into the Belle Fourche system down into Guernsey. It hooks into the Enbridge system, which transports oil, of course, into the Clearbrook, Minnesota. And then, of course, its own Belle Fourche system, which takes oil to Mandan for the refining at the Tesoro refinery.
So basically this pipeline will hook into two different feeder systems
Two different feeder systems for transport plus the refinery for transport as a refined product. And that therein lies really, I think, the most interesting thing about this pipeline, and that is that it provides an efficient economic opportunity for moving oil not into one market but into three different markets. And while it doesn't enhance the interstate transmission capacity at all, it does create a more efficient and economic way to move the oil as well as much safer way to move the oil.
Kevin's exactly right. When you hold a commodity that is in demand, it's so critically important to have multiple market opportunities to send that commodity to. Because if you're captive to just one market, your leverage goes down significantly. If you're a producer and you can access multiple markets, it makes a huge difference. So it's a good thing for North Dakota producers, mineral rights owners, people like that.
Do we have any idea how much oil this will take off the road?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you ask that because that was my very question sort of walking in here. I wondered what the capacity of that would be. We should find that out. Yeah, pretty easily. It's, yeah. You know, it's, but we'll call the company and find that out, Dale, because that's a good point, good question.
The 230 kV power line, is this, could you describe what the support structure for the line is? Is it metal? Is it wood?
I think they're wood H-frames, if I remember the pictures right. Is that right, Jerry?
The ones that are in there are wood.
You're right.
I think they're H-frame. And there was still some question on what they were replacing them with.
We don't know what they're replacing them with?
I'll have to look it up, but there were two possibilities, if I remember right.
And is the problem here that the portion of the line is to be moved is the support structure is underwater?
Yeah, Dale, I can give you a copy of this map here, but basically what it is the existing route cuts just across the north end of the lake itself, and so there are concerns about the towers that are in that area. They have some riprap and things like that they're going to be proposing placing around the new towers so that they avoid the problem in the future. But it's basically just that the towers themselves are exposed to a lake that has gotten bigger, and once the ice starts to flow, it can just shear those towers right off. This is an important reliability line, too. This is a line that we have had our eye on for some time. It was, I believe, the same line that had significant trouble a few years ago, if you remember the Thanksgiving weekend ice storm. So it's an important regional reliability line, and it's one that we want to protect.
Could you explain how having the support structure, or at least part of it, underwater is a problem?
Sure. The ice is does significant damage to pole structures. I mean, ice is a powerful enough force, and if you get some winds associated with ice in the spring, it will snap those things just like they were toothpicks. And once they go down, then you lose a very important reliability line for the entire region.
The best example I could use in that, Dale, is what we were talking about is, you know, docks and lakes. People take their docks out because you leave your docks in. When the ice goes out, they take everything with them, and that's exactly what could happen right here.
So that's why my dock is always missing.
That's why you should take it out, Dale.
Yeah, do it before October or November.
Can you tell me when the Bridger pipeline was put on the agenda?
It was put on the agenda this morning, actually. What had happened is we received a letter of intent, I don't know, a month ago, I suppose, Pat, something like that. They had asked us to shorten the waiting period to one day at that time, but with no indication when they would be filing their application. We've stopped sort of just automatically shortening those waiting periods to one day because we've got a pretty heavy load around here. So we sat on it a little while and looked at our calendar, cleared things out a little bit, and so today, by shortening it basically 30 days, we're allowing them to apply, you know, any time now. So we're in pretty good shape there.
So what you're saying is the success of what's been happening with the development of energy means that you can't shorten it to one day anymore.
That's exactly right, Dave. You know, and you guys, I think, probably even commented on this in the past, that this shortening the waiting period to one day was pretty automatic because it was fairly easy for us to do. Well, suddenly we've got applications. And by the way, pipeline applications are some of the most most urgent because of the economics, because of the safety issue, and because of the access to markets that bottleneck, which has created these economic burdens really on our own producers and the landowners and mineral rights owners and all of those things. The other thing about the pipelines that tend to create some urgency, of course, is the construction season, and that's certainly true of wind farms as well. And wind farms are another one of those projects or developments that come up very quickly and tend to demand quick results. So you're right. The success of development in North Dakota has created a bit of a time crunch in the regulatory process, which is why we asked for and received one more person on our staff to be involved in the regulatory affairs of the commission and to help expedite development. Some people think that adding staff in a state agency is counter to business. In our case, it actually helps us expedite business development and investment in the state. So we're just not quite as – keep in mind, by the way, though, the waiting period is 1 year. So shortening it to 30 days is still a pretty good response by government.
The BNSF hearing, you're having it here? Or did you consider, like
– the Civic Center?
Yeah, we did, and I can't remember how we came to that discussion because, and I thought about that this morning. I mean, there may be a need if we have significant enough interest, which we might, to move it to a different room. Daryl, did we look at all at the Brynhild Hoglund room to see if that's...
No, we haven't looked at any other room yet, but I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, there's a chance that we may either just proactively move it there before we get to that point, or at least have an alternate available in case this room is too small.
Well, I...
What do you think? let's take your advice on this.
How many of your neighbors are you signing up to get?
I mean, I think you could fill up this room in the worst weather of the year, so I think this room is way too small. But that's just my opinion.
Depends on your goals. Well, one thing about our goals is we do like public interaction. We've never shied away from it, and have always welcomed it, so we want to be able to accommodate it.
Yeah.
How much... I mean, I was reading the testimony from the National Guard. How influential is it when the National Guard describes it as a private crossing?
Well, you know, there are a couple of issues here, Dale. One is whether it's a private crossing or not. And
right.
I mean, the commission can take that issue up itself. If it's not deemed to be a private crossing, then it's a public crossing, and all of the Federal Rail Act safety issues come into play. And so federal law would basically take over whether that whistle needs to be blown or not. Now, if it is deemed to be a private crossing, and if it truly is, which is a determination the commission itself can make, then as a private crossing owner, and I'm, you know, maybe making a little bit of a snap judgment here, but I think that the owner of the private crossing has some weight given to their opinion of whether they think the whistle should be blown or not. They are, after all, the owner of it. Having said that, I mean, we're interested in hearing from everyone on the issue that might have an interest in it, whether they cross that particular crossing frequently or not. I think the guard in its letter indicated that they believe about 300 people use that crossing each day, which means if they're using it twice, there's about 600 crossings going on in a day. So it receives a fair amount of traffic. The guard itself didn't take a position on whether they thought it should the whistles should still be blown or not, but they provided that for our information. But in addition to the owner of the crossing, we want to hear from people who are affected by it, either feeling that they think it should still be blown because they use it, or they may have, you know, kids that play in the area or whatever, or that, you know, they don't want it to be blown because they're tired of hearing it after so many.
We actually considered in our work session, Dale, splitting this question not only as two items to be considered at the hearing, but actually having two different hearings. But given the both the public interest in it and, of course, the timelines required for notice and whatnot, we thought that might just frustrate people more than accommodate a reasonable logistics issue. So we're going to take both issues up. We'll take both issues up because we won't make any decision, of course, at the hearing.
I was just wondering if you considered the fact that the letter describes the crossing several times as a private crossing, whether you consider that as a indication that that is the preference that they have.
I didn't take it as an indication one way or another if they felt the whistle should be blown or not. I think that they were putting that in there to go on record to state that they believe it's a private crossing. Bottom line is state law indicates that it's the commission that determines whether it is or not. But really, whether it's a private crossing or not, once you make that determination that it is, it's a totally separate issue of whether the whistle should be blown or not. And that has to do with the public safety, has to do with, you know, obstructed views, a whole lot of other issues. So once you make that call, it's really a totally separate issue.
Because it was just kind of interesting to me that we have a crossing here that's fenced in but also has a lot of traffic.
Yes.
Right.
It seems like
it is a unique characteristic of this particular crossing. There's no question about it. But that somebody calling it a private crossing doesn't make it a private crossing, which is why we have to have a hearing to determine whether it meets the criteria or not.
Right. And I get the sense from talking with our own counsel, who has been, you know, talking with the railroad, that I think they feel a bit of that tension too. I mean, it's a private crossing. It's within a fence, but it's fairly heavily used as far as private crossings go. I mean, the ones that we have had to this point have been private crossings out in the middle of a field where, you know, you might get somebody crossing that once every 3 months.
Yeah.
This is a lot different.
And in those cases, there was the railroads weighed in with what their opinion was. With this case, they right. kind of let that sit. So we make the big bucks.
The wind...
How come I don't?
The wind rankings. What is the significance of this other than some bragging rights, I guess.
That is a significant. people will now invest. If you're a wind investor and all of a sudden you see North Dakota on the top 10 list, you haven't thought about North Dakota, you might come give us a look. That's what I think is the most significant point.
I think it is significant, Dale, for that reason. I think what it does is it demonstrates one more time that North Dakota is the go-to place for energy investment and development, whether it's traditional energy like oil pipelines like we just dealt with, or renewable energy like wind energy that we're dealing with now, or coal mining, or biofuels, or refining. This is the place to make an investment during good economic times and during difficult economic times. And I think that's also significant. You know, the challenges of the capital markets over the last couple of years have not had the impact on North Dakota that they've had on other energy-producing states. And I think that's perhaps the most significant part of it. A lot of people like to say that North Dakota is lucky because we have all these resources. We're an energy-producing state. Therefore, you know, it's easy to have a balanced budget, for example. Well, the fact of the matter is there are a lot of energy-producing states that we're doing better than, in fact, pretty much all of them. So I think Brian's exactly right. I think what this illustrates is that North Dakota is the go-to place for energy development and investment.
Right. I mean, God gave us the wind, and there's nothing we could do about that. But the bottom line is that this development can take place a lot of places. I mean, North Dakota does have the best wind potential, but it's not as if there aren't other states that have good wind energy potential and in some ways have some advantages, like they're a lot closer to market, so they don't have quite the transmission challenges that we do. So, I mean, you're right, it's symbolic, but it's also significant, just like North Dakota moving up into position number 4 on the top 10 oil-producing states is significant. It's symbolic of the type of development that's going on here, and it's symbolic of a whole lot of policy choices that have been made along the line by citizens, by economic development groups, by the governor, the legislature, regulators, all the way down the line that have allowed this kind of investment climate to happen.
Well, go ahead.
I just never saw a college basketball crowd chanting, "We're number 10.
That's what I was going to say. When you go from 50 to 10, that's pretty significant. And I would say, too, I think it's always important to remind North Dakotans and the country that while we are a very fast-growing state in terms of energy production, energy investment, we also do it without compromising the integrity of our rich natural and cultural resources. I'm very proud of both the investment climate that we help create as regulators, but also the protections that are in place that we oversee with great diligence and without compromise. So, again, it takes a team effort. It's not just one agency or just the investment community or just the development community or just the culture of the community. It's all of the above working together.
So who gets the number? Which one goes to number one first? Oil or wind?
Oh, good. Well, I think there are just certain geographic and geological issues that will make that very difficult. When you consider that Texas at number one in wind is 9,410 megawatts and our 1,203 are number 10. Now, the good thing is, though, that we're within 40 to 70 of jumping up two spots, you know, even in the wind side. So it's probably more likely that we'll move up quicker now, but we're also not at number four. But there are just certain realities that are going to be difficult to overcome at the very top of the list. Not the least of which is our access to markets. I would say this, though. Once some more transmission is built, you will see, I think, another explosion, if you will, in wind development in North Dakota. As we know, there are some 5,000 megawatts of wind projects at some level of oversight in our queue, mostly letters of intent at this point. But once a major transmission line is built out of North Dakota into the marketplace, we will see, I would think, a couple of billion or more dollars worth of investment quickly.
You know, the other thing about Texas, the other thing that Texas has as far as an advantage that we don't, they have 20 million people and their own grid. Yeah. I remember the ERCOT, which is the Electric Reliability Council of Texas. I mean, for the most part, Texas is a self-contained electric grid. It's not regulated by FERC. They don't have to worry about crossing state lines. They don't have to worry about any other state siting a transmission line. If, as a state, Texas decides to build lots of transmission lines and allow rate recovery for those and allow for that wind power to develop in a state that also has, frankly, pretty good wind resources, they can do it. Texas, in a lot of ways, has advantages with wind. Another is the huge natural gas supply. Wind and gas pair very well together. They're a natural gas-driven market, so I think they'll be tough to overcome. But there's no reason it's not a goal.
Just like the
aim high, baby. Well, they do have that.
No, he's Oklahoma.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right. Just look at his airplane. Yeah, he does.
You know, the interesting thing, Kevin's talking about regulations we have in place. North Dakota actually has, I'm talking about a regulatory climate that seeks to both balance investment and the rights of property owners, making sure you're doing the right thing and it's rolling out in the right way. A lot of wind-producing states, Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, they don't have any state oversight of the siting of the wind towers themselves. I think we've taken a very proactive approach in making sure there are appropriate setbacks, dealing with flicker and noise and things like that that they just haven't there.
Well, Tony brought out, and we talked a lot about cap and trade, this commission in the past, and it's the regulatory certainty that they get in North Dakota is why we have investment here. People know what they're going to get when they come here. I think that is the key point. You know what, you invest your money now, you know what your return on investment is going to be, you know if projects come online, they're actually going to do it in this state. It's because the governor, the legislature puts in place things that make this happen. Mm-hmm. It's not just by coincidence at all.
Nope.
Anything else? If not, we'll recess while we sign orders. We'll come back for the administrative portion of the meeting in, let's say at 11:15.